Thank you. Thus ends the Piano Quintet in F-sharp minor from Venezuelan composer Reynaldo Hahn, performed by the Parisi Quartet with pianist Alexander Turo on Kansas Public Radio. The time is 1:39, a little over 20 minutes until NPR News at the top of the hour, with more classical music to follow until 3 this afternoon. Later on tonight, it's Friday, and that means Film Music Friday with Daryl Brogdon. Tonight we're at war with the movies on this evening's program with memorable themes from classic war films. Among those are Patton, Bridge on the River Kwai, and Objective Burma. Daryl Brogdon is your host for Film Music Friday. That's tonight from 7 to 9 here on Kansas Public Radio. Support for classical music comes from Delta Dental of Kansas, as when they last visited a dentist. For a preventive checkup, dentists can be found at deltadentalks.com/find. And Green Lady Lounge, featuring Kansas City jazz musicians and their original compositions. Located at 1809 Grand Boulevard, KC. Information at greenladylounge.com. So it is the 1st of November, and we have a special treat for you next by composer Arnold Bax, one of his tone poems that was written in 1917, which is a gorgeous depiction of nature. They call this November Woods. Bryden Thompson here to lead the Ulster Orchestra. Next on Kansas Public Radio. from composer Arnold Bax, music created in 1917, a tone poem called November Woods, performed by the Ulster Orchestra on Kansas Public Radio. It is just about 2 p.m., and news from NPR is ahead. In the next hour of classical music, it'll bring us quite a bit, music by Claude Debussy and from Tchaikovsky, the Romeo and Juliet Fantasy Overture. Support for classical music on KPR comes from the Midwest Trust Center presenting Hiprov, starring Colin Macri and Asad Makey, Sunday evening, combining hypnosis and improv for a totally unique live comedy experience. Details at jccc.edu/mtc.
Edgar wrote the vampire novel Dracula, but years before that came out, he wrote a ghost story, Gibbet Hill, that was lost for more than a century. That is, until someone recently found it.
Immediately called each other, and I think probably swore more times than we ever have collectively on a phone call before, because we immediately thought, this is huge, this is global.
I'm Elsa Chang. More on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered coming up today from 3 to 7 at your place for NPR News. Kansas Public Radio is KANU in KANU HD1 Lawrence, KANH in KANH HD1 Emporia, KANV in KANV HD1 Olsburg Junction City, KANQ Chanute. This month's KPR Community Spotlight is on Americana Music Academy in Lawrence, providing in-person and virtual lessons, jams, house concerts, events, and workshops to Douglas and surrounding counties. Lesson and scholarship information is available at AmericanaMusicAcademy.com.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. Vice President Harris, moments ago in Madison, Wisconsin, defended her campaign trail ally, Republican former Congresswoman Liz Cheney, after former President Trump said guns should be trained on Cheney's face.
Anyone who wants to be president of the United States who uses that kind of violent rhetoric is clearly disqualified and unqualified to be president.
The Trump campaign says a GOP nominee was expressing his view that Cheney wants to send young people to war despite never having fought herself. The Harris and Trump campaigns are competing for votes in both Wisconsin and Michigan today. A lot of eyes will be on Pennsylvania on Election Day, one of the nation's most pivotal swing states. NPR's Windsor Johnston has been reaching out to voters there with 4 days left before they go to the polls.
Sarah Hutchins of Philadelphia County says she wants to see Vice President Kamala Harris become the first female president.
It's long overdue at this point, and I wish it wasn't even part of the discussion, because it's like, what does it matter? But it's like, it has to be.
Tammy Rigaway, a Republican from Allentown, says this will be her third time voting for Donald Trump.
I'm a Christian. I think that Donald Trump has all my values. I think he will help our world get back to being normal.
Alice Brawley is among the roughly 3% of voters who are still on the fence.
I have not decided how to vote, and I may not even vote because I'm not happy with the people running. How's that for an answer?
Windsor Johnston, NPR News.
Israeli forces damaged offices of the UN agency in charge of Palestinians' affairs in the Israeli-occupied West Bank, according to the UN. The Israeli military issued a statement denying responsibility. Here's NPR's Kat Lonsdorf.
The damaged offices belong to the UN Aid Agency for Palestinians, or UNRWA, in the Nur Shams camp in the West Bank. The Israeli military raided the camp during what it called a, quote, counterterrorism operation. The head of UNRWA, Felipe Lazzarini, tweeted that Israeli forces bulldozed the offices beyond use, which he says were a hub for basic services for more than 14,000 Palestinians in the camp. In a statement, the Israeli military denied Lazzarini's account, saying that, quote, terrorists planted explosives near the offices, which were then detonated. Relations between Israel and UNRWA have been increasingly strained. Israeli parliament voted earlier this week to ban the organization, which would severely impact aid in both Gaza and the West Bank. Kat Lonsdorf, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
The head of a UN-backed fact-finding team investigating abuses in Sudan says the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces is responsible for large-scale sexual violence against women, men, and children. The RSF's war against Sudan's military has been raging for more than a year and a half. You're listening to NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from Progressive Insurance, where drivers can compare direct rates using Progressive's rate comparison tool. Customers can see options and rates side by side. More progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. We're live, we're local. We are Kansas Public Radio. was a joyful little tune from Emil Waldteufel, the French waltz master. That was a polka called The Flock of Birds. Eric Kunzel was conductor of the Cincinnati Pops Orchestra for us, getting things started in our 2 o'clock hour of classical music. I'm Jeff Watson, and happy to be back with you. We are anticipating a visit of the Athena Ensemble and some chamber music from the essential catalog of works of Claude Debussy, the Sonata for Flute, Viola, and Harp, and Tchaikovsky's Romeo and Juliet Fantasy Overture, all just ahead. Support for classical music on KPR comes from the KU School of Music, inviting KU alumni to return to the 100th Annual Vespers Choir, singing alongside fellow alumni while commemorating a century of Vespers tradition on Sunday, December 8th. Details at music.ku.edu. Next, we have music created in 1917 based on Hungarian folk song from Zoltán Kodály. The Orpheus Chamber Orchestra gives us the Hungarian Rondo, next on KPR. that one created in 1917, the Hungarian Rondo of Zoltán Kodály, performed for us by the Orpheus Chamber Orchestra. The time is 2:19. You're listening to classical music on a Friday afternoon with work of Tchaikovsky, about 15 minutes away from us. The Berlin Philharmonic Orchestra will join us soon for the Romeo and Juliet Fantasy Overture, coming up on Kansas Public Radio. Support for classical music comes from Cromwell Solar. Since 1982, installing automatic backup battery systems for uninterrupted power for residential homes or businesses. More information is at cromwellsolar.com. And the Topeka Symphony presenting with Rimsky-Korsakov's Procession of the Nobles and Grieg's Piano Concerto performed by Cheung Park. Tomorrow, tickets at topekasymphony.org. Joined next by the Athena Ensemble for music by Claude Debussy and work that was created towards the end of his life in 1915 during a time when his major project was creating a series of chamber music pieces for unusual combinations of instruments. In this one from 1915, we are floated into a magical dreamscape in the Sonata for Flute, Viola, and Harp. Next on Kansas Public Radio.
Thank you.
final works by Claude Debussy, created in 1915 the Sonata for Flute, Viola, and Harp, performed for us by the Athena Ensemble here on Kansas Public Radio. We've got a little over 20 minutes to go until 3 o'clock, and all things considered from NPR News. Tonight, from 7 to 9, Daryl Brogdon is your host for Film Music Friday. The holidays are just about upon us, and so is KPR's Big Band Christmas, coming up on Saturday night, December 14th, at Liberty Hall in Lawrence. It's the KC Jazz Orchestra to serenade you with some big band jazz and holiday favorites. Tickets for a Big Band Christmas are on sale at Liberty Hall and at Ticketmaster.com. Made possible in part by Dr. Stephen H. Chronister, Healing Smiles of Topeka. 64 degrees here at the KU campus, about as warm as it's expected to get today. Sunny skies, tonight mostly clear, lows in the mid-40s. Rain is in the forecast for the weekend. Tomorrow, cloudy and a high of 62 and a 60% chance of showers for tomorrow afternoon. Showers likely Saturday night. Showers and thunderstorms possible. We'll have a low of 56 and excellent possibility of showers and possibly thunderstorms as well on Sunday. This month's KPR Community Spotlight is on Americana Music Academy in Lawrence, teaching, promoting, and supporting the advancement of all forms of music, lessons and scholarships available for students of all ages. Details at AmericanaMusicAcademy.com. And now we arrive at the Berlin Philharmonic Orchestra and music of Tchaikovsky, who had a great passion for the works of Shakespeare and would compose a trio of orchestral suites based on different Shakespeare plays. The one that we'll hear from 1870 was done at the urging of his colleague Mili Balakirev. Conductor Claudio Abbado is here to lead the Berlin Philharmonic in Tchaikovsky's Romeo and Juliet Fantasy Overture, next on Kansas Public Radio. so ends the Romeo and Juliet Fantasy Overture by Tchaikovsky, played by the Berlin Philharmonic Orchestra, led by Claudio Abbado on Kansas Public Radio. And with that, it's almost 3 o'clock. All things considered from NPR News just ahead. I'm Jeff Watson. Thanks for joining me for classical music here on a Friday afternoon.
Hello, I'm Felonice Lovato Winston, KPR General Manager. Now is a great time to become a sustaining member of KPR or to upgrade your sustaining membership. With our fiscal year end approaching, support like yours is crucial. And right now you'll get a KPR enamel pin when you donate $7 per month or more. Donate now at kansaspublicradio.org.
We're live. We're local. We are Kansas Public Radio from the University of Kansas, KANU and KANU HD1 Lawrence, FM 91.5, KANH and KANH HD1 Emporia, FM 89.7, KANV and KANV HD1 Olsburg Junction City, FM 91.3, KANQ Chanute, FM 90.3. Listen online at kansaspublicradio.org or tell your smart speakers to play Kansas Public Radio. It's 3 o'clock.
Just open up the report this morning. It might make your stomach drop a little bit. But fortunately, as you dive into the data, there are things going on here definitely underneath the surface.
How much did a strike at Boeing factories and a pair of hurricanes slow down hiring last month?
It's Friday, November 1st, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Ilse Chang. Ahead this hour, when it comes to immigration restrictions and enforcement, some of President Biden's policies look an awful lot like former President Trump's.
The Democratic Party is adopting the same policies that the MAGA Republicans have been advocating for.
Plus, if you are not quite done yet with Halloween this year,
we've got news of a long-lost short story by the author of Dracula.
Spotted an advert for a short story by Bram Stoker called Gibbet Hill, and I went, what the heck? I have never seen that before in my life.
First, the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. Former President Trump in Dearborn remains unapologetic for calling one of his most vocal Republican critics, former U.S. Representative Liz Cheney, a radical war hawk and implying she should have rifles trained on her.
If she had to do it herself and she had to face the consequences of battle, she wouldn't be doing it. So it's easy for her to talk, but she wouldn't be doing it. She's actually a disgrace.
The former president habitually lashes out at anyone who opposes him. Vice President Harris in Madison says Trump's violent rhetoric should disqualify him from running for president.
His enemies list has grown longer, his rhetoric has grown more extreme, and he is even less focused than before on the needs and the concerns and the challenges facing the American people.
Cheney's been campaigning for Harris, urging other Republicans worried about a second Trump presidency to declare it in their vote. Both campaigns are in battlegrounds, Wisconsin and Michigan today. In Michigan, the running mates are hitting on today's disappointing jobs report. Republican Senator J.D. Vance fires up a crowd in Portage.
We are not garbage for being off that the country just lost 46,000 manufacturing jobs in a month.
Democratic Governor Tim Walz tells a union crowd in Detroit that when Trump was in office, the country lost jobs.
During the time Donald Trump was president, we lost 2.7 million jobs.
The Labor Department says that last month the economy gained 12,000 jobs, far below expectations. Factors include two major hurricanes and a massive Boeing strike. U.S. officials say Russia is behind a video falsely claiming a Haitian immigrant voted more than once in the swing state of Georgia. NPR Shannon Bond reports it's the latest hoax believed to come from a Russian operation pumping out staged videos in the final days of voting.
The video shows a man claiming he arrived in the U.S. from Haiti 6 months ago. He says he and others are voting for Vice President Kamala Harris in multiple Georgia counties. But state and federal officials say it's a fake, likely created by Russian propagandists trying to undermine confidence in the election. Officials say Russia is also behind other recent fake videos, including one purporting to show ballots being destroyed in Pennsylvania. The videos have circulated widely on social media, particularly Elon Musk's X. Georgia Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger has called on platforms to take the Georgia video down. Shannon Bond, NPR News.
The death toll from flash floods in eastern Spain has risen to at least 205. The figure is expected to keep rising as the search for unaccounted people continues today. In Algeria, a journalist outspoken during the country's 2019 pro-democracy protests has been released from prison. The Dow has closed up 288 points. You're listening to NPR News. Teenagers who spend four or more hours a day on screens are more likely to experience depression and anxiety. That is according to a new report from the CDC's National Center for Health Statistics. Here's NPR's Maria Godoy.
The report is based on data collected between July 2021 and December 2023. Teens themselves describe their typical weekday screen use, not counting the time they spent doing schoolwork on screens. The report found that about half of all U.S. teens ages 12 to 17 spent at least 4 hours a day on screens, and one in four teens who spent this much time on screens said they'd experienced symptoms of anxiety or depression within the previous 2 weeks. Teens who had less than 4 hours of daily screen time were significantly less likely to report these symptoms of mental health problems. Maria Godoy, NPR News.
In Los Angeles, a victory parade and celebration ceremony for the World Series champions, the L.A. Dodgers. The Dodgers beat the Yankees in New York Wednesday night, overcoming a 5-0 deficit to win 7-6 in Game 5, their second World Series title in 4 years. Tourists in the Eternal City, hoping to keep with the tradition of tossing a coin into the famed Trevi Fountain, have to settle for seeing their coins land in a small, nondescript pool in front of the Baroque masterpiece. The fountain is being drained for maintenance. The Dow's closed up 288 points. The S&P was up 23. The Nasdaq was up 144 points. I'm Lakshmi Singh, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Sony Pictures, presenting the new movie, Here, reuniting the director, writer, and stars of Forrest Gump, a tale of love, loss, laughter, and life. Here is now playing only in theaters.
From the University of Kansas, this is KPR, Kansas Public Radio.
Support for KPR comes from the Midwest Trust Center at Johnson County Community College, featuring the Opus 76 Quartet, Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse live in concert, and more this season. Tickets at jccc.edu/Midwest Trust Center.
Mostly clear skies this evening with a low in the mid-40s. It is 65 degrees in Lawrence, and it's 3:06.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly in Washington. The headline on this morning's jobs report suggests hiring in the U.S. slowed to a crawl last month. But economists say don't put too much stock in that one, admittedly, discouraging number. The reason? The ongoing strike at Boeing factories in the Pacific Northwest distorted the government's monthly tally of jobs. So did that pair of back-to-back hurricanes that disrupted business in the Southeast. NPR's Scott Horsley joins me. Hey, Scott.
Hi, Mary Louise.
Hey, so any headline, any news, especially big economic news, feels huge this close to Election Day. And in an election when voters say the economy is a top concern, against that backdrop, what should we make of this jobs report?
Probably not too much. You know, it would be nice with an election 4 days out to have a really clear signal about the strength of the job market. Unfortunately, though, the signals in today's report are pretty murky, clouded by those storms and that strike. That's why economists like Corey Staley at the Indeed Hiring Lab say you shouldn't be too dismayed by the headline showing employers added a measly 12,000 jobs in October.
If you just open up the report this morning, it might make your stomach drop a little bit. But fortunately, as you kind of like dive into the data, there's some other things going on here, definitely underneath the surface.
We know, for example, the Boeing strike, which is now 7 weeks old, idled more than 40,000 workers. That accounts for nearly the entire drop in manufacturing jobs last month. The effects of the hurricanes, Helene and Milton, are harder to quantify, but they surely put a temporary dent in employment. And those storms made landfall just shortly before the government conducted its monthly headcount of workers.
What if we just took those storms and the strike out of the equation? I mean, do we know how the job market would be performing without them?
Most economists think the job market is cooling down, but only gradually, not falling off a cliff. And one sign of that is the unemployment rate, which held steady last month at a low 4.1%. If the job market were really falling apart, you would expect to see some increase in the unemployment rate. So that's reassuring. Now, there are other signs that hiring has slowed down from what had been a blistering pace. You know, the number of job openings has come down. Employers are no longer bidding up wages as fast as they had been to recruit workers. But Staley says wages are still climbing, and now that inflation's cooled off, workers' paychecks are actually stretching further than they used to.
People are still getting, you know, decent raises, you know, good news for workers. Then as you look even outside the labor market, we see, you know, GDP is still strong. We see consumer spending. Overall, when we take all of these indicators into account, this is a solid labor market we're still in.
Now, one other footnote in today's jobs report. Because of a quirk in the calendar, employers had less time than usual to respond to the government survey, and a lot of employers just didn't respond. So that also may have skewed the count. We're going to have to watch and see if these numbers bounce back next month.
Although, before then, in fact, next week, we have some big decisions to make. There's the presidential election, of course, and also the Federal Reserve meeting to decide about interest rates, right?
Yeah, just 2 days after the election, Fed policymakers are going to meet here in Washington and decide whether to cut interest rates again. The Fed's keeping a close eye on the job market, and the weaker the job market seems, the more aggressive the central bank might be in cutting rates. If you took today's jobs report at face value, you might expect another supersized rate cut from the Fed, but, you know, markets are not taking this report at face value. Investors think the Fed is going to proceed cautiously and probably cut rates by a modest quarter percentage point next week.
Thank you, Scott.
You're welcome.
NPR Scott Horsley.
How could the next president change the course of the wars that Israel is fighting in the Middle East? Well, as NPR's Daniel Estrin reports from Tel Aviv, U.S. elections are already making a difference in Israel's calculations.
It's no secret that Israel's right-wing leaders hope former President Donald Trump returns to the White House. Tali Gottlieb, a lawmaker in Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's party, told NPR at a rally, "Of course I don't want Kamala Harris, who thinks we're committing a genocide in Gaza, to be elected." The vice president has not said Israel is committing a genocide. A poll of Israelis this week found only 17% favor Harris, 66% favor Trump. Both candidates want a quick end to Israel's wars in Gaza and Lebanon, but in different ways, says Shmuel Rosner, an Israeli commentator on American politics.
I think with Kamala Harris, Israel will probably expect a more confrontational approach that aims to, in some ways, tie Israel's hands. With Donald Trump, it seems as if Israel is going to be somewhat freer to pursue the war the way it wants to do it, without putting too much restrictions.
A Harris administration and Israel would struggle to find common ground on post-war Gaza. Harris has said there should be no reduction to Gaza's territory, while many in Israel's right wing are calling to seize at least part of Gaza's land after Hamas's attack last year. Amit Segal, a commentator perceived as being close to Netanyahu, said on Israeli TV, if Trump is elected, Israel may, quote, change the borders of the Gaza Strip as punishment for what happened on October 7th. In Gaza, NPR producer Anas Baba met Alaeddin Abu Hassera looking for flour rations. He said Trump and Harris are, quote, the same thing. Nothing will change. They're both watching us die. Regarding the West Bank, Trump's former ambassador to Israel has a new book advocating Israel annex that occupied territory. Palestinian analyst Ibrahim Dalalsha of the Horizon Center think tank says Harris would oppose West Bank annexation, but would not solve the core of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict.
That would be like a smarter conflict management kind of policy. But I don't expect it to be a strategic intervention to resolve the conflict.
The Biden administration has stepped up efforts to resolve the conflicts in Lebanon and Gaza. Any achievement could help Harris in the elections. Nadav Strauchler, a political strategist who previously worked closely with Netanyahu, says Netanyahu is waiting.
In the current situation, he could have done more to help this administration
to gain more points, maybe, but he won't run to do it right now. I don't see him rushing for a deal until the election. He will wait. So this is something that doesn't help this administration and maybe somehow does help Trump.
Iran is one front where the identity of the next president could matter most. After Israel's bombing of Iranian air defenses last week, Israeli officials are beginning to promote an idea that used to seem out of the question, bombing Iran's nuclear weapons capabilities. Israel would need U.S. support to do that.
Netanyahu sees it as the story of his life to change the situation with Iran. I think he was waiting for the election and he seek for the option to finish this threat.
He thinks Netanyahu sees a better chance to do that with Trump in office. But this might be Netanyahu's big ask, no matter who is in the White House next. Daniel Estrin, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
A different election will happen this weekend across the Atlantic. Members of Britain's Conservative Party will elect a new member. Whoever wins will be tasked with rebuilding the political party of Churchill and Thatcher after its worst ever election defeat. NPR's Lauren Freyer reports from London.
And as Big Ben strikes 10, a Labour landslide.
Blimey, the Conservative Party looks pulverised tonight.
Britain's Conservatives were pulverized at the polls this summer, despite dominating politics here for more than a century. Robert Lord Haywood, a Conservative member of the House of Lords, says the way his party is now trying to rebuild is by playing to the extremes.
A certain element of the British population is watching what's happening in the United States. You can't avoid it.
Haywood says moderates have been voted out of this leadership contest by fellow MPs, and the last two candidates standing...
They're not actually household names in the United Kingdom, which is why they've gone for a populist approach to attract the headlines.
Politicians on this side of the Atlantic are also diving into culture wars by saying stuff like this.
Of course, not all cultures are equally valid. I don't believe in cultural relativism. I believe in Western values.
That's Kemi Badenoch, the frontrunner to lead the UK Conservative Party, arguing on TV that immigrants from certain cultures should be more welcome here than others. She's also said she thinks paid maternity leave is, quote, excessive, and that while her parents are wealthy, she herself is working class because she worked a fast food job as a teenager.
Now, lots of Brits quickly made fun of her, saying, you can't just be working class because you had a job in McDonald's.
Katie Balls is political editor of The Spectator, a right-leaning magazine here. She says Badenoch...
She is very much known for talking about identity politics. She's sometimes depicted as an anti-woke warrior.
Now, some see that as an unlikely role for Badenoch. She's a black woman and a mother of three who grew up in Nigeria.
And people listen to her in the way if it was a man they may not have done.
Badenoch would make history as the first black leader of any major UK party. Her challenger, fellow MP Robert Jenrick, is most famous for quitting a cabinet post over a proposal to deport migrants to Rwanda in Africa.
Davis has called it moral delinquency, and the Times reported that Prince Charles privately called the plan appalling.
The Rwanda plan was panned by human rights groups and overturned by the courts. But for Jenrick, it wasn't tough enough. He's also called for peaceful protesters to be arrested if they chant Allahu Akbar, God is great, at pro-Palestinian rallies. And he told a pro-Israel group that he wants the Star of David posted at UK borders.
So that at every airport and point of entry to our great country, there is the Star of David there. As a symbol that we support Israel, we stand with Israel, we are friends and allies.
Now, some of these views might not seem out of place in U.S. political discourse these days. Others are pretty unconventional, even fringe. But after losing votes this summer to a far-right anti-immigrant party, the staid-old party of Winston Churchill and Margaret Thatcher may be taking a page from the GOP playbook and making a tactical shift. Tomorrow we'll learn who its next leader is and how much the party might change under them. Lauren Freyer, NPR News, London.
This is NPR News.
From the University of Kansas, this is KPR, Kansas Public Radio. We broadcast at 91.5 FM in Lawrence, 91.3 FM in Junction City. We are always online at kansaspublicradio.org. And you can check out our app. We have a version for iOS and a version for Android, wherever you prefer to get your apps.
Support for KPR comes from FW Houston Medical Center 24/7 walk-in clinic, serving the healthcare needs of the Jefferson County area no matter the time of day. More information at 913-774-4340.
Thanks so much for tuning in this afternoon. Lots of important things to talk about today. In our next 30 minutes, an update of news headlines. Then, President Biden has issued a number of immigration-related executive actions mimicking those of the Trump administration. Vice President Harris has promised she will continue some of those restrictive policies. Sergio Martinez Beltran will tell us more about it. We will talk about corporate debt collections and small claims court. We will find out why Halloween is one of the busiest wedding days of the year in San Bernardino County in California. Those stories and much more still to come. Stick around.
Support for KPR comes from the Topeka Zoo, presenting Zoo Lights and the chance to host a private party or special event in a secluded igloo at the zoo. Details and reservations at topekazoo.org.
Don't forget we have music coming your way tonight following All Things Considered on your KPR One station's Film Music Friday returns tonight. Going to war with the movies. Themes and overtures from classic war films, including Patton and Bridge on the River Kwai. Daryl Brogdon is your host. Film Music Friday, 7 to 9 p.m. on KPR One.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Your Part-Time Controller, the nonprofit accounting specialists, providing financial support to stronger nonprofits who make the world a better place. Learn more at yptc.com/NPR. From Eric and Wendy Schmidt, through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all. On the web at theschmidt.org. And from ECMC Foundation at ecmcfoundation.org.
This is All Things Considered. From NPR News, I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Elsa Chang. While early voting continues in many parts of the country, let's head to Florida. It may not be a key swing state in this presidential election, but voters there are still focused on the contest and on some big ballot measures, like one on abortion. NPR's Ashley Lopez talks to early voters in Florida about their decisions.
For many past election cycles, one of the most closely watched parts of the country was Florida's I-4 corridor. It's politically mixed and stretches from Orlando down to Tampa. Along that stretch is Haines City, which is where Marisol Lopez voted during one of the first days of in-person early voting. She had her mind made up on the presidential election and two big ballot measures in the state.
I just don't want Trump to be president again, honestly. Yeah, pretty much. And, I support abortion, and I'm pro-choice, and marijuana, pretty much. Those three things.
Florida currently has a 6-week abortion ban, one of the strictest bans in the country. Lopez says she supports a ballot measure that, if passed, would allow abortions until fetal viability, which is usually around 24 weeks.
I'm terrified. You know, it's never been good when we're, stopped from making choices on our bodies. And I have two girls, so that's very important for me.
Christella Bradley in Lake Alford is also in favor of abortion rights and is backing Vice President Harris as well. But she says she doesn't support a proposed amendment legalizing recreational marijuana.
I'm just tired of smelling it. I don't want to smell it when I'm at the grocery store. I don't want to smell it when I'm out anywhere. That was a huge issue for me.
Teresa Ford also voted early in Lake Alfred. She, however, voted for Trump.
I just can't. I think that if it doesn't turn out Trump winning, I think we could be in big trouble as a country.
And while Ford didn't vote for the ballot measure enshrining abortion rights in the state's constitution, she did end up voting for the recreational marijuana measure, even though she has mixed feelings about it. Mostly, she says, she hopes it generates more tax revenue for the state.
Now, you know, I'm a little apprehensive, but I still voted yes because I think it will make a lot of money for hopefully the right reasons.
Ballot measures can be kind of a wild card in elections, not just because some issues cut across party lines. They're also known to make it hard to predict who is going to vote. But in Florida, a lot of voters said their biggest motivation to vote this year was what most voters in the country are focused on, issues like the economy and democracy. Hector Caban in Orlando, who voted for Trump, says the national debt and high prices are his main issues.
I mean, I'm paying more for gas, paying more for definitely food. Insurance obviously is a big deal around here in Florida.
Andrea Grand has bigger picture worries. This voter in Orlando was an independent voter for many years, and this year he's backing Harris.
I look at the values this country has to offer, and the values would be one of them, as I said, is to respect the Constitution.
Agrand, who is Haitian, says he also hasn't liked how Trump has talked about immigrants, including his comments about a Haitian community in Ohio. He says he also made his decision by thinking about which candidate would best represent this country's values in the long term. And while Trump is largely expected to win the presidential race in Florida, the fate of the state's ballot measures may be tougher to predict. Ashley Lopez, NPR News.
Meanwhile, the world is watching the U.S. election, maybe nowhere more so than in Ukraine, where the outcome is seen as a matter of national survival. Ukraine's president says he refuses to give up territory for a peace deal, no matter who wins on Tuesday. But the view from a coal mining town in eastern Ukraine, where Russian troops are advancing, it's more complicated. NPR's Joanna Kakissis has our story.
The town of Dobropilia is just about 20 miles from the front line. Russian missiles frequently strike here. Mechanic Dmytro Mosin points to a bombed-out dormitory. It's scary, he says, but here we are. He and his neighbors are huddling around outdoor spigots, chatting as they fill containers with drinking water. The Russian invasion cut off the town's main water supply. I bring up the U.S. presidential election, and Volodymyr Maruch, a coal miner, says he's really wound up about it. The candidate who supports us is Kamala Harris, he says. I am hoping Donald Trump is not as stupid as we think he is, this fool in a special relationship with Vladimir Putin. Russian troops already occupy 80% of Donetsk, the coal mining region this town is part of. And those troops are outside another coal hub, the nearby city of Pokrovsk, which is also a key supply center for Ukrainian soldiers. Ihor Kurdia is Dobropilia's deputy mayor. He says a third of his town's residents are refugees from Pokrovsk and other besieged cities. But no one is safe from Russian missiles. Just a few days ago, he says, one missile killed a four-year-old girl here. Kurdia is a former high school history teacher. He knows everyone in town. He waves at a kindergartner and his parents as we walk through a largely deserted playground. I worry about our people, he says. I want to save their lives. I want this war to end so mothers do not cry in Kyiv or even in Moscow. He also wants Ukraine to get its land back, and he believes Americans, regardless of their politics, support Ukraine's victory. When there's a new U.S. president, he says, I don't believe we will lose American friends. At a cafe called Sunrise, owner Tatiana Rejeda is less optimistic. She worries the U.S. has lost interest in Ukraine. I hope whoever becomes the next American president, she says, can at least get us to the negotiating table. At her cafe, she says she often hears women sobbing because their sons and husbands have died on the front line. She'd rather save lives instead of territory. I doubt we will return to our pre-war borders, she says. We have to be realistic.
Stop. Одну минуту.
Outside the town's hospital, medic Ilya Poltatsev helps a young pregnant woman who is blacked out. He evacuates Ukrainians from nearby towns captured by Russian troops, and he has a plea for the American presidential candidates. If you have a magic pill that will end this war, he says, we are willing to buy it from you. He says it feels like Ukraine is losing allies and might not survive. He's even willing to make a desperate offer to Vladimir Putin. Even if I have to kneel and beg for the bloodshed to stop, he says, I will do it. I will give up everything I own. Depending on who wins this Tuesday, he says, he hopes Ukraine won't have to do the same. Joanna Kakissis, NPR News, Dobropilia, Ukraine.
This is NPR News.
The new movie Here covers centuries of stories without moving the camera.
Whenever you're trying something different, there's always a fear element that it isn't going to work.
And there is five or six other scenarios of completely different characters at different times.
Exactly.
That are wrestling with that same thematic crisis of life.
Tom Hanks and director Bob Zemeckis reunite. Saturday and Weekend Edition from NPR News.
Join us tomorrow morning, 7 to 10 a.m. on your KPR stations for Weekend Edition Saturday. Your hosts are Scott Simon and Kay McIntyre.
Support for KPR comes from KU Theater, presenting Hook Man, a darkly comic salute to teenage slasher films, reminding everyone that college can be scary. Playing now through November 7th. Tickets at KUtheater.com.
News headlines are coming up next. Lows tonight in the mid-40s, showers tomorrow with a high in the lower 60s. This is KPR. It's 3:30.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. The Biden administration hopes to allow DACA recipients to buy health insurance through the Affordable Care Act.
But 18 states are suing to stop that.
This issue is not about a lack of availability. It is a lack of accessibility.
First News.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Dwayne Brown. The government says employers added just 12,000 jobs in October, far fewer than forecasters had projected, as the effects of strikes and hurricanes left many workers temporarily off payrolls. Michael Regan is a senior editor at Bloomberg. He says this report also shows efforts by the Federal Reserve to cool down high consumer prices and inflation are paying off.
It really looks like we're hitting that proverbial soft landing that economists talk about, where the Fed's been able to contain inflation and while not really doing much damage to the job market. You know, that said, the election is next week. Politicians don't usually have a lot of nuance when they talk about the economy. So this report certainly could be a talking point and already is a talking point on the Republican side.
The Labor Department says the ongoing strike at Boeing and the impacts from hurricanes Helene and Milton distorted the latest jobs report for October more than expected. Iranian officials say they intend to retaliate against Israel for an attack last weekend that took out several of Iran's air defense systems. NPR's Arzu Rezvani has more.
The deputy commander of Iran's Revolutionary Guard Corps, Ali Fadavi, said Iran's response is definite, adding that Iran could destroy all that Israel possesses in, quote, one operation. Fadavi made these statements in an interview with Al Mayadeen, a pro-Iran Lebanese news channel aligned with Hezbollah. Israel and Iran have been attacking each other directly over the last 6 months, raising fears of an all-out war between the two countries. It's Iran's Supreme Leader Ali Khamenei who has ultimate authority to order strikes, and he faces a choice, to retaliate and risk further escalation, or stand down and risk looking weak to supporters inside Iran and regional allies. Arzu Rezvani, NPR News, Beirut.
Looks like more Wendy's restaurants are closing on top of the 100 that were set to be shuttered this month. This is NPR.
For Kansas Public Radio News, I'm Laura Lorson with your regional headlines. Kansas tax collections came in below estimates in October. Emily Younger of Kansas News Service filed this report.
Kansas tax collections were about 3.4%, or $23.4 million, lower than state estimates. It's driven largely by corporate income tax collections, which came in nearly 37% below estimates. Total tax revenue is down 2.5% from this time last year. October marks the first month since May that Kansas tax collections were below the forecast. Overall, the state retains a healthy surplus, but the budget forecast for the rest of the fiscal year will be updated later this month. For the Kansas News Service, I'm Emily Yonker.
Candidates in one of the key contested seats in the Kansas legislature sat down for a debate today on radio station KCUR. Competing to represent State Senate District 10 in Shawnee, Republican incumbent Mike Thompson and Democratic challenger Andrew Maul traded barbs on Medicaid expansion, cannabis legislation, and abortion. Kansas law bars abortions at 22 weeks, but provides exceptions in cases of rape, incest, or when the mother's life is in danger. Thompson said those exceptions are contrary to his personal beliefs.
There's a difference between my personal opinion and what we have in the state legally right now.
Maul says he supports Kansas laws that permit abortion access, including those exceptions. The state of Kansas has a small but steadily growing immigrant population, but a recent survey from the Midwest Newsroom and Emerson College polling reveals almost half of Kansas voters think immigrants have had a negative impact on the state. Kathleen Alonzo is with the voting advocacy group New Frontiers in Southwest Kansas. She says she attributes the poll results to harmful messaging about immigrant communities.
Part of it is shocking, but part of it I can also understand, especially because of the rhetoric that we have heard over the last few years about the immigrants.
Approximately 28% of voters said immigrants have had a positive impact on Kansas, while just over a quarter said they were unsure. It's 3:35.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Sony Pictures, presenting the new movie Here, reuniting the director, writer, and stars of Forrest Gump, a tale of love, loss, laughter, and life. Here is now playing only in theaters. From Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates, all from one platform. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly in Washington. The Biden administration has been backing more enforcement, restrictions, and punishment for people who cross into the U.S. without authorization. This has been in response to shifting views on unlawful immigration. Many of Biden's policies resemble those pushed by former President Donald Trump. That's got immigration rights advocates wondering whether Democrats will ever again focus on proposals like legalizing the millions of unauthorized migrants in the country. NPR's Sergio Martinez-Beltran reports.
One of the policies that has had the most impact during President Biden's administration severely limits asylum at the U.S. southern border. It's been in effect since June, and it temporarily suspends most asylum claims. The policy is said to have led to a 55% drop in unauthorized crossings.
The effect is devastating for asylum seekers and especially for families with children.
Ilora Mukherjee is the director of the Immigrants' Rights Clinic at Columbia Law School. She says tens of thousands of migrants are stranded in Mexico as a result of Biden's asylum ban. Biden used the same rule former President Trump used in 2017 to ban immigration from several majority Muslim countries, and in 2018 to suspend the right to petition asylum for migrants crossing the border illegally. Biden's recent actions as president go against what he did on the same day he was inaugurated, where he reversed many of Trump's rules.
The Democratic Party is adopting the same policies and postures that the MAGA Republicans have been advocating for over the last 6 to 8 years.
In a statement to NPR, a White House spokesperson says the Biden administration has, quote, put forward a balanced approach in order to secure our border and make our immigration system more fair and just, end quote. An example, the White House says, is Biden's 2023 humanitarian parole for Cubans, Haitians, Nicaraguans, and Venezuelans, which allows citizens of those countries to legally enter the U.S. after being vetted. The program is being phased out, even though the administration credits it with lowering arrests at the southern border. Bruna Solid, the senior political director of the immigrant youth-led United We Dream Action, hopes a potential Harris presidency could mean more legal pathways for immigrants.
I know it won't be easy, because it never is. These things are not easy. Politicians, I've learned through this work, never do anything out of the kindness of their hearts. You know, they do things when they're pushed.
Solid and other advocates say misinformation spread by Trump has seeped into the heads of voters, and Democrats have been left with trying to be seen as tough. Recent surveys from the Pew Research Center show an overwhelming majority of Trump and Harris supporters back improving border security. Nearly 30% of Harris supporters back mass deportations.
The thing is, you're never going to seem tougher on immigration than Donald Trump, who has promised mass detention and deportation of people.
The Harris campaign declined to comment and referred NPR to remarks the vice president made in Arizona last month. There, she called for revamping the immigration system. She vowed more punitive measures for migrants who cross without authorization and called for a pathway to citizenship for, quote, hardworking immigrants who have been here for years, end quote. Solid says that if Harris wins, immigrant rights groups need to push for a different approach on how to deal with migrants and the southern border. Sergio Martinez Beltran, NPR News, Austin.
Small claims courts are supposed to be the so-called people's courts with informal procedures that make it easy to bring your claim. But Jennifer McKim from our partner station GBH News reports that Massachusetts courts are flooded with corporate debt collectors that are pursuing low-income people, and it's a problem nationwide.
I'm standing outside a courthouse north of Boston with Colette Carlino, a single mother fuming about what happened to her on her court date.
I'm in the negative at the end of the month. Like, I live check to check. I do not get help. I have my three kids.
Carlino is being sued over a credit card debt of about $1,000 in charges and fees. She says were racked up by her ex-husband. She sobbed inside as she attorney for the debt collector that she couldn't afford to pay it back.
I still have to figure out how to make ends meet, and you want me to rob Peter to pay Paul to pay you. And you want me to, what, forfeit my kids' medication? You want me to forfeit their transportation to their program?
Small claims in other civil courts across the country are inundated by cases like Carlino's. Big companies suing low-income people over relatively small amounts of money. A new report filed by the Massachusetts Trial Court shows companies filed more than 92,000 consumer debt cases last year. Nearly half of them came from three firms that buy old debts from credit card companies at a steep discount. Consumer advocates say these eye-opening numbers provide much-needed tangible evidence of a nationwide problem they are attempting to better understand and to fix.
We've tried to do that in other states as well, and we consistently see that debt collection lawsuits are the most common type of civil court case in the country.
That's Erica Rickard, who directs the Courts and Communities Project at the Pew Charitable Trusts. She's looked at cases in small claims and general civil courts across the country. She says these suits can have a long-term impact on people's finances, affecting housing and quality of life.
What we see is not only this high number of debt collection lawsuits around the country, but we also see very consistent things in what happens in them, which is largely people do not participate in the case, and they experience a judgment against them that comes with court-enforced debt collection. So a really high percentage of these cases end in somebody's paychecks or bank account being garnished.
A spokesman for Midland Credit Management, who sued Carlino, declined to give a recorded interview. In an email, Faryar Borhani said filing suit is a last resort. Midland tries to work with debtors and suspends collections for a variety of reasons, he says, including job loss. He argues debt collectors are needed to assure accountability and help debtors improve their credit. Midland and its partner companies make up one of the largest such firms in the country. They also have faced legal complaints from regulators in Massachusetts and D.C. for violating fair debt collection laws.
Okay, folks, so thank you all for your patience as we went through the first call of the list.
During another court hearing in Boston last spring, legal aid attorney Kristen Borzale of Greater Boston Legal Services said when defendants in collection cases show up in court and are represented by attorneys, they usually win.
people don't realize that they have legal rights. They don't realize like who the debt collector is and the relationship with the original creditor, and that there's an opportunity for them to still show up, explain their story, and win, even if they may have owed a debt to this original creditor.
But the recent report found the vast majority of defendants facing consumer debt suits lacked an attorney. About half of defendants lost their cases because they didn't show up at all, sometimes confused by who was suing them or because they didn't get notice, advocates say. Borzale works with one of the few programs in the state that provide volunteer lawyers to educate consumers.
It feels like, you know, we're sticking our finger in a dam. There really needs to be a systemic look at the debt collection industry and the small claims legal framework for how it's handled.
In court, Carlina learned from a clerk that she didn't immediately have to pay the debt because of her low income, but it will hang over her head for years. Carlina said she only learned later that she could have fought to dismiss the suit altogether. For NPR News, I'm Jennifer McKim in Boston.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Every couple wants their wedding to be beautiful. On Halloween yesterday, many also chose to make their ceremonies beautiful. About a dozen couples got married in a once-booming silver mining town that many believe is haunted out in California's Mojave Desert. KVCR reporter Madison Ament reports.
Calico Ghost Town is nestled in dry, purplish mountains right off the freeway that connects California to Las Vegas. Walking down the bustling and dusty Main Street, the tall wooden and adobe facades of the saloon, general store, and town hall cast long shadows. And then, at least yesterday, makeshift altars dotted the town.
For richer or poor.
Richer or poor.
In sickness and in health.
In sickness and in health.
Michael Gibson and Susan Fletcher had eloped. They promised till death do us part in town hall, as hundreds of pairs of eyes from turn-of-the-century black-and-white photos looked on.
We like skulls, we like scary movies.
Fletcher says they used to be part of a ghost-hunting team.
We've been paranormal investigators. We both had experiences and stuff like that.
About 10 other couples joined them in saying, yep, wait for it, I boo. In fact, Halloween is the second most popular day, next to Valentine's, to get married in San Bernardino County, where Calico is. So Chris Wilhite, the San Bernardino County clerk, says they decided to open this new venue for the day and give couples a little of what they'd get if they went one county east into Nevada.
We're close to Vegas, but we bring Vegas to San Bernardino County with the marriages.
Wilhite dressed up as a cowboy to perform ceremonies. Many brides wore black gowns, like the Adams family matriarch Morticia. In fact, the day gave new meaning to having a case of wedding day jitters.
They do say that the church is haunted here, the Lane house is haunted.
That's Melissa Lacey, who grew up nearby and wore a skeleton sweater to marry her fiancé.
I mean, if you have the energetic feels about you, you can just walk in these buildings and feel the energy.
Some say the ghost of Lucy Lane, who ran the general store, sits at her window at night. Others say a teacher hangs around the schoolhouse. While the paranormal draws people to Calico, that's not why it's called a ghost town. Beata Davis runs the San Bernardino County Parks Department that operates Calico.
Once they could no longer draw silver out of the mine, everybody picked up and left all at one time, leaving it empty and a ghost town.
That was in the early 1900s. Nevertheless, Lacey, who brought along some family members to her wedding, hoped a few more would join.
I'm hoping that some family members' spirits come through as well.
Probably one of the only places where wedding crashers are encouraged. For NPR News, I'm Madison Ament at Calico Ghost Town.
Okay, from crashing weddings to crashing through the backcountry. Women who fight fires for the U.S. Forest Service are organizing, hoping to improve the balance between their careers and family life. We'll hear from the Women in Wildland Fire Advisory Council about the things they hope to change so they can stay in the job they love. That's tomorrow on All Things Considered. Make sure to come back for that. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
This is Nick Carswell. Join me this Saturday at 5 p.m. on KPR for 105 Live, where we continue to showcase new music made right here in Kansas. Our live session this week comes from the stage of the Bottleneck with the Draper Family Band.
This is Brandon Draper from the Draper Family Band. Join us for our live studio session on 105 Live on Kansas Public Radio.
This is your place for NPR News from the University of Kansas, Kansas Public Radio, 91.5 FM in Lawrence, 96.1 FM in Lawrence, lots of other frequencies all around the state as well, and always streaming at kansaspublicradio.org.
Support for KPR comes from the Lead Center, welcoming the classical trio of Edgar Meyer, Tessa Lark, and Joshua Roman, performing on bass, violin, and cello. Sunday, November 3rd, 2 p.m. Tickets are at lead.ku.edu.
Stay tuned. News headlines coming your way in about 12 minutes. Then we will hear about veterans and how they are getting involved in the upcoming election. A lot of veterans pushing back on conspiracy theories. We will learn more. Find out about the big mistake that got made at the Department of Motor Vehicles in San Francisco. We will also get you an update on that terrible flooding in Spain. The death toll continues to rise. People are very unhappy about the government response. The latest on the Spanish floods coming up on KPR.
KPR's Community Spotlight is now accepting applications from local nonprofits who need help spreading awareness about their mission. We'll highlight your organization for a month using KPR's airwaves. Details at kansaspublicradio.org.
It's 65 degrees in Lawrence, 67 in Manhattan at 10 minutes before 4.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Elsa Chang. The Biden administration has plans to allow a new group of Americans to buy health insurance through the Affordable Care Act. We're talking about DACA recipients, also known as Dreamers, a group of adults who were brought to the U.S. without documentation when they were kids. Many are uninsured as adults, and with the Affordable Care Act's open enrollment kicking off today, some are hoping to buy an affordable insurance policy. Scott Massioni from member station WYPR has more.
There are more than 500,000 DACA recipients living in the United States, and about 100,000 of them don't have insurance. A new federal rule would allow them to go to the ACA marketplaces and shop for a health policy. And like anyone else, depending on their income, they could qualify for federal subsidies to make the insurance more affordable. Dania Casada Torres came to the United States from Mexico when she was 5. Until now, health insurance was never a sure thing.
When I was very young, I had health insurance through my dad's job. But that was very inconsistent, just given the nature of his job. And so sometimes I had it, sometimes I didn't.
After she graduated from Emory University, but before she got into law school, she was unable to get health insurance for a while. She would go to safety net clinics when she had to, and once she delayed getting care for an infection. If a doctor sent her to the lab for expensive tests, she would just skip it.
This issue is not about a lack of availability. It is a lack of accessibility. In simple terms, without this change in the law, I and many others with DACA status, we cannot afford the monthly premiums, the deductibles, the co-pays, that all form part of a pretty standard healthcare plan.
But there are already challenges to the plan. Republican attorneys general from 18 states have filed a lawsuit to stop it. Those states say allowing DACA recipients to buy insurance coverage will strain local resources, in part because it will encourage undocumented people to stay in the United States. However, because the lawsuit's ongoing, some DACA recipients could purchase subsidized insurance this November, but then lose coverage later, depending on the federal ruling. For NPR News, I'm Scott Massioni in Baltimore.
And this story comes from NPR's partnership with WYPR and KFF Health News.
Now, to good news for a group of fans who've been waiting more than a century for new content. A short story by Dracula author Bram Stoker was discovered by a pharmacist in Dublin. The story first appeared in an Irish newspaper back in 1890. Now it is being independently published. It's called Gibbet Hill. A gibbet is a gallows, for those who may be wondering, and it's a gruesome tale about three children who accost a man on the road. NPR's Megan Lim has the story.
In a way, this story actually starts in 2021, when Brian Cleary woke up suddenly deaf in one ear.
I remember coming home from the hospital when I was told it was permanent and the tinnitus was melting my brain. And it's a dark situation.
It's called sudden sensory neural hearing loss. The condition required him to get a cochlear implant and relearn how to hear. So he turned to music.
I needed to listen to very simple sounds so that my hearing could develop and I could learn to differentiate pitch again and to learn to appreciate music again. I was like a little baby. I was learning to hear, you know, so I figured lullabies might be a good place to start. It's just one simple note at a time from a glockenspiel.
These lullabies became something of a soundtrack to his life, and he would listen to them while pursuing another task that helped him cope, writing. It started with a blog, but then he moved to another long-time goal of his, writing an 18th century historical fiction inspired by a local hero.
I live near where Bram Stoker was born, so I actually pass that house every day. So I have an interest in local history.
He'd go to archives at the National Library of Ireland, playlists in tow, and look up all things Stoker.
I was systematically going through every newspaper report of Bram Stoker as part of my world-building process for my own writing.
One day, he stumbled on a newspaper from 1890.
I spotted an advert for a short story by Bram Stoker called Gibbet Hill, and I went, what the heck? I have never seen that before in my life. And I've read a lot about Stoker. And I started holding my breath because I thought maybe this is lost work from Bram.
So he had to find it.
I go flying back through the editions, back to the 17th of December one, and I race through the pages to the supplement, and sure enough, I'm looking at Gibbet Hill by Bram Stoker, all rights reserved.
Tom Lawler is co-director of the Bram Stoker Festival in Dublin. He's one of the people Cleary called up after making the discovery.
When we heard the full details, myself and Maria and Nisha, who's our associate director, got off that Zoom call, immediately called each other, and I think probably swore more times than we ever have collectively on a phone call before, because we immediately thought, this is huge, this is global.
The story made its debut at the festival last week with a reading by Irish actress Eileen Walsh.
A tombstone by the roadside, marking the spot where a century ago a poor seaman trudging on his way from Portsmouth was murdered.
It is rare that you have 200 plus people gathered in a room with pin drop silence for a half an hour at any event. And when Eileen Walsh was reading that story, that's exactly how the room was.
Then the snake twined itself around the child's ankle and began to climb its way up his body, wriggling around and around his leg and thigh and up and up.
Sure, finding something like this is any history nerd's dream, but how does it measure up to his other work?
I could see instantly that this was an important story, an important addition to the Stoker canon.
Paul Murray is a Stoker biographer. He says what's most significant about the finding is the year it was published, 1890. That's the year Stoker started working on Dracula. And Murray says that there are echoes of themes found across Stoker's career, like snakes and evil children. Lawler, the festival's co-director, also had thoughts.
The thing that strikes me the most is just this is the kind of casual, banal nature of the evil in the story. Three figures. The rationale for their sort of toying with the central character is never really explained.
But regardless of how the work is ultimately viewed, Cleary, who made the discovery, hopes it'll contribute to Stoker's legacy in a different way.
The beautiful part of the story for me is that the funds that are going to come from this are going to be ring-fenced into a fund called the Charlotte Stoker Fund. This fund that's named for Bram's mother, because she was a campaigner for deaf children back in 1863.
And Murray, the Stoker biographer, thinks we may not even know the author's full canon with this discovery. He told me Stoker had lots of stories that were lost to time, and they're just waiting to be unburied. Megan Lim, NPR News.
With only days to go before election night, Vice President Kamala Harris and former President Donald Trump are making their final pitches to voters. And in a race that's super close, success will come down to getting out the vote. So, how are the two parties approaching this just days before the election? Find out by listening to the Consider This podcast from the team here at All Things Considered. Find it wherever you get your podcasts. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from San Jose State University, with 100-plus graduate and research programs ranging from AI to wildfire science. Their graduates and their ideas are working to fuel innovation in Silicon Valley and beyond. From the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, recognizing extraordinarily creative individuals with a track record of excellence. More information on this year's MacArthur Fellows is at macfound.org. From Fisher Investments, as a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their clients' best interest. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. And from ECMC Foundation, at ecmcfoundation.org.
I'm Peter Sagal. If you're worn out by alarming election news, we'll wear you out with news about everything else on this week's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me from NPR.
Join us tomorrow morning beginning at 10 o'clock on your KPR1 stations for Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, the weekly NPR news quiz. We're live, we're local, we are Kansas Public Radio from the University of Kansas, KANU and KANU HD1 Lawrence 91.5. KANH and KANH HD1 Emporia 89.7. KANV and KANV HD1 Olsburg Junction City 91.3. KANQ Chanute 90.3. Listen on the web at kansaspublicradio.org or tell your smart speaker to play Kansas Public Radio. It's 65 degrees in Lawrence, 65 in Topeka, 68 in Emporia. It is 4 o'clock.
We want to mobilize vets to be visible, to be out, and to help restore a sense of safety to folks.
How military veterans are thinking about and participating.